I am Linda Smith, and I'm a grateful recovering Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. She knows about my enthusiasm because I made her run through to get me some caffeine a while ago. I said, you got to perk me up where I can keep going. But if you're sleepy at this time of day, just go ahead and take a nap. It won't bother me. I want to thank Jerry and the committee for inviting me. It's really an honor and a privilege to be here and to be asked to come. All of you could probably stand up here and do a lot better than I'm going to do, but the most important thing to me is to be here with you and to see and share love, you know, to be with you and share with you. I've seen some people I haven't seen in a long time. I've got to meet new people, and I just thoroughly enjoy that. If that's enthusiasm, I just love it, if that's part of enthusiasm. But I do appreciate the opportunity to be here. How many Al-Anons does it take to screw in a light bulb? None. We sit back, detach, and it screws itself. That's the only joke I know, and my friend told me that one. So I'm not much of a joke teller. But anyway, I was thinking when she was telling me that joke, I could never sit back and let anybody do anything because I'm a very controlling person, and I had to do it myself because I could do it better than they could do it. And I had these characteristics before I ever lived with an alcoholic. I didn't grow up in alcoholism. I grew up in what I call a good Christian family. Mother and father and three sisters and a grandmother. We went to church every time the church doors were open. And I wasn't around drinking. Didn't know anything about it. We had a good family. Of course, there's problems in every family, but it was a good home. And the older I get, the more I know it was a good home. But anyway, I do have a problem. I won't say I did. I do have a problem with control. I've had to learn how to detach from a lot of things. But this started, like I said, when I was a child. And what I did then was if you played with me, you had to play the way I wanted to play, or I wouldn't play with you. And I was the kind that I always wanted things my way, and I knew what was right. If I was playing with my sisters and they didn't like what I was doing, I wouldn't play. So this is how I grew up. And I also grew up thinking that I wasn't quite as good as other people. We didn't have as much money. And I would, you know, think I was less than. So what I would do, I would overcompensate. And I would think I would act like I was better than. So I started acting at an early age. And I knew how to present a front and act like I was okay. And you know, I'm so grateful today I don't have to do that. I know, Jerry said it to me before I started this, I know that if I don't do a good job up here, you're going to love me anyway. And that's what's so great about talking with AA and Al-Anon people, or in front of AA and Al-Anon people, or even talking to them. So that's how I grew up. And like I said, we were in church, and I was taught when I was growing up to pray, thy will be done, and I always said that. Well, I grew up and I met this guy, and he drank. Well, by then, after I got out of high school and went to college, I tried it, but you know, I didn't like it, and the reason I didn't like it is because I already felt like I was in control, and when I drank that stuff, I didn't feel in control. And so that's the difference. And but for the grace of God, it could have done the other for me. I've heard so many alcoholics say that it made them feel more in control of the situation. But it didn't do that for me. I felt like I was losing control, so I didn't drink. But I met this guy, so then it was acceptable. You know, it became acceptable. Drinking was okay. And he drank, and we started dating. And you know, I always had this in my mind that I was going to meet this knight in shining armor. We were going to get married, have a little white house with a picket fence, two children, and live happily ever after. And I always saw in the movies how they get down on their knees and propose to you. So he was supposed to do that. You know, he never did learn how to play his part. all those years. So we dated and we dated and we dated for 7 years. And he still had not done it. I didn't want to tell him to do it. But as it went along, I finally... Well, see, we would go to parties and he would drink. And he could drink anybody under the table. Well, that made me feel important. I was with him and he was the life of the party. But as those 7 years went along, I look back now and know that he was an alcoholic and his alcoholism was progressing. I didn't know it at the time, but I would be embarrassed as time went on because he'd get drunk and pass out at a party. He was no longer the life of the party. And of course, I thought that reflected on me. But anyway, so we're going along after 7 years. I decided it's time we got married, so I told him we were going to get married, and we did. So we got married, and I thought, you know, I already knew that he drank too much, but if I married him, he loved me so much that he would quit. I knew nothing about alcoholism. So we get married, and guess what? He didn't quit. The drinking got worse. So I had chosen him, so it was my responsibility to make him quit drinking. And I took it to heart. I did everything I could think of to make him stop drinking. I'd pour out his liquor, then I'd go buy him some more because he had DUIs all the time. He even had a DUI before I married him. And he was always getting in trouble with the law. So I'd go bail him out of jail when he'd get in trouble, you know, and I'd go buy his liquor where he wouldn't drive and go get it himself. I played all the games. I nagged, I hollered, I screamed, I loved, I did everything I could do to make him stop drinking. We'd been married about a year and a half, and we were going to see his sister who was in the hospital. She had a 2-year-old son that I kept a lot, so I decided, see, I have this little bit of problem with ego. I learned after I got in this program that ego is easing God out. So Linda was in charge. And so I have this little problem about I. So I decided that my husband and his sister's little boy needed to go see her in the hospital. Well, my husband never went anywhere that he didn't have his ice chest full of beer. And he also hunted a lot and he had guns and he always took his guns. Or that day he took a lot of his guns. So we head out, and she was in the hospital in Augusta. And we head out on this trip, and I'm driving. And he's in the back seat with his beer, and he's okay that morning. He's drinking his beer, and he cleaned his guns and reloaded them. And the little boy's in the front with me, and we head up to Augusta. And we visit his sister. He got away from me. Now, I was already into playing the games. I'm going to keep up with him, not let him get the keys, not let him go anywhere. I had to watch that alcoholic all the time. So I was playing these games, but I was busy with the little 2-year-old and with his sister, and he left. But he came back, and he seemed to be so upset about his sister, but it was time for us to leave, so we hadn't eaten, so we went across to like a Hardee's, and I took the 2-year-old in to feed him and to feed me, and my husband said, just leave the keys, I'm going to sit in the car. And I said, okay. So I went on in the restaurant, and we're eating, and I looked out, and there he goes. And so I just left the 2-year-old sitting there. I ran out, and somehow he had not pulled out into the traffic. I ran out, and I somehow got the front door open, turned the car off, got him out of the front seat, into the back seat, went back in and got the 2-year-old, came back out and got in the car and headed out of Augusta. Now, I had seen my husband drunk a lot, but I had never seen him quite like he was that day. Of course, y'all know what he did when he left the hospital. He went and got some vodka. That beer wasn't doing it. He had to have something else to drink. He was very drunk, but he was also talking very strange. I'd never seen him quite that way. So I've got to fix everything, you see. So I'm telling him everything's going to be okay. I can handle it. You know, it's going to be okay. So I reach back through the bucket seats, and I'm trying to soothe him and talk to him. And he grabs my arm, and I'm trying to drive, and he almost breaks it. And I finally get my arm back, And we're going on, and he sees a liquor store, and he said, stop at that store. And I said, no, we can't stop. I've got to get this child home. And he pulled a loaded gun on me. And he said, I said, stop. I stopped. I have never been so scared. I had never been so scared to that point in my life. I was praying, and I was saying, oh my God, this child's seeing this. And I thought, what am I going to do? I was talking. I was trying to get him to understand it was me. Everything was going to be okay. I would take care of it. And I didn't know what was going to happen. About that time, some friends that knew the car had been to see his sister, and they thought we had car trouble, and they stopped. And of course, when they stopped, he threw the gun down. If he hadn't, you might have a different speaker today. But anyway, he threw the gun down. And the couple that had stopped, the man got in the car, and I wanted to say, I need to tell you what's going on, and I felt like I couldn't talk in front of him and tell him what was happening. But they knew a little bit about the history there. So the man got in the trouble with me, in the car with me, and the woman took the little boy, and then we head on home. And we get home, and I got the little boy to sleep, and I finally got the alcoholic to sleep. And I laid there with my eyes open all night, and I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? Well, I couldn't tell anybody. I never had fear like that, and I just pushed it down inside, and I thought, I can't let anybody know how I feel and what has happened. See, now, I was 28 before I married in the first time, and all my friends were married and having babies, you know, and all this. Well, I couldn't be a failure. I couldn't get out of that marriage. Because I didn't want to be a failure, and I had chosen him. So I'm laying there at night thinking, what am I going to do? I put this, like Rip, you say, I put this brain to work. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? And what I came up with, well, I've got to really redouble my efforts. I've got to make him stop drinking. So I've got to try harder. So when morning came and he woke up, he did not remember, and I truly believe that he was in a blackout, and he did not remember anything that had happened. And so, of course, I told him in detail. And he promised me that he was going to quit. And he did for 3 or 4 days. And you know, I really, truly believe that he meant that. He really meant that he was going to quit, and he couldn't. But anyway, the fear is what I like to talk about, because that fear was eating me up and I would not tell anybody. And time went on, and finally there was a minister. Now, I didn't know anything about AA and Al-Anon back then, but there was a minister that I used to go talk to, and I would tell him my troubles. And so I was talking to him about it, and I finally told him about it, which you all know, when we tell things, they're not so, I mean, you know, we can handle them better. We can deal with it better when we share. So I began to get a little better, and I began to be able to talk about it. Well, my husband was not a violent man. He never was. I was verbally abusive. I was even physically abusive sometimes. He was very quiet. He just drank and passed out. But I couldn't let him just drink and pass out. I couldn't. I was the one that caused the turmoil that went on. That's how sick I was. You know, when I heard that this is a family illness, alcoholism is family illness, I really know how it affected me, and I know that it is a family illness and that we're all affected from alcoholism. So we're going along, and he's drinking, and he's beginning to have some health problems, and this minister said he knew about treatment centers and about alcoholism, about AA. And so he finally said, we need to get him some help. So we convinced him to go to treatment in 1977. And he went, and I thought, wonderful, he's gone for the cure. And I was actually 12-stepped. Not many Al-Anons are. But I was actually 12-stepped. While he was going to treatment, a friend of his mother and daddy were in AA and Al-Anon, and I used to say they heard that about him, and I realize now they knew about me. But anyway, they called me, two women from the Al-Anon group called, and they came to my house and they brought literature, and they talked to me about themselves, and they told me about Al-Anon and invited me to a meeting. Well, now, you know, I'm so relieved that he's in treatment. I don't know if any of you were like that. I was so relieved because the pressure was off for a minute, because I had to watch him all the time and make sure he didn't get in trouble, so when he's up there, you know, I feel like he's safe. But anyway, they told me about it, and they invited me to come, and I got his mother to go with me, and so we went to an Al-Anon meeting. And there was an Al-Anon speaker, and I thought it was wonderful. And I got literature, you know, picked up the free pamphlets, and I read them, and I just thought this was wonderful. But see, I didn't need it. He'd gone for the cure. When I got in Al-Anon, I heard about the three C's. I didn't cause it, can't control it, and can't cure it. And I thought I had caused it, because he kept telling me if I would do this, or if I would do that, or if I wouldn't do that, he wouldn't have to drink. And at first I knew that wasn't true, but years of living in alcoholism, I began to believe that. And then I had tried just about everything I knew to control it, and I hadn't been able to control it. And then I have learned that it can't be cured, but it can be arrested and can be helped. But anyway, at that time I really thought he had gone for the cure, and there was nothing wrong with me. I thought, so I didn't need Al-Anon. So I didn't go back to a meeting. Well, it got time to go to the treatment center and get him, and oh, I was so happy. Everything was going to be wonderful. We were going to get that little white house with the picket fence. We were going to have those two children. We were going to live happily ever after. So I get to the treatment center, and everything's going good, and we leave, and he looks wonderful. You know, he'd been there 28 days, and they were feeding him good, and he wasn't drinking, so he looked great. Everything's wonderful. We get home. He gets drunk that night. So we get on the merry-go-round. The more he drank, the more I was going to make him stop drinking. The more I was going to make him stop drinking, the more he drank. Then I decided, now let me tell you this right quick. And from 1977 to 1984, I never once thought about going to Al-Anon or AA as the solution. And the reason I didn't is because I was in control. And as long as I'm in control, I don't need anybody else. So I decided he needed a psychiatrist. So I started taking him to a psychiatrist. And one time I put him in a mental unit in a hospital for a week. And when he got out, he looked at me and he said, "If you ever put me anywhere else, I'll kill you." And that fear that I had pushed down inside came up, and I thought, well, I'm not going to do anything else. I began to be a good martyr. Oh, poor old me. People would say, "How can you live with that sorry drunk?" And I would think I was so wonderful because I could stay with him. I was so sick. I heard somebody call themselves the three M's when I got to Al-Anon. They said they were mother, manager, and martyr. I could relate. I didn't have those children, so I treated him like a child. He acted like a child. And I could manage anything, thank you. I was working, paying the bills. He didn't have to work. He just had to drink. I could manage anything, I thought. And martyr, like I said, I could play the martyr so good. You know what this is? The Al-Anon salute. But I was a real good martyr. But I decided to take him to the psychiatrist. We were going to get these problems solved. So I took off work, drove him out of town for him to see a psychiatrist on an outpatient basis. And he goes in, and I sit there. He drinks on the way up there. He drinks on the way back. Of course, I had told the psychiatrist everything before it all started. And we go week after week, and finally the psychiatrist wants to talk to me. He had convinced the psychiatrist that he didn't have a problem, that I did. And the psychiatrist believed him. Oh, that made me mad. Of course, today I know that I did have a problem, but then I did not think anything was wrong with me. But I was so furious that he didn't go back to that psychiatrist. So I didn't take him there anymore. Anyway, we're going along, and it's just getting worse and worse. He's drinking more and more, and things are happening. And like I said, I'm getting sicker and sicker and don't even know it. I think I'm okay. Because, see, on the outside, I look okay. I go to work, I function, I dress nice, I look nice, and I don't understand, and you know, I don't let anybody know that what's going on inside. When I got to the program, I heard an AA speaker talk about the first step, that they were powerless over alcohol and their lives were unmanageable. And I finally, when I got here, could admit that I was powerless. But I could not see how my life was unmanageable because I managed everything so well. And I heard the speaker say that that did not say your affairs are unmanageable. It says your lives, and that's what's going on inside you. That's what's going on with you, your emotions, your feelings. And so I could finally relate to that, and I realized, yeah, mine's a mess. So in 1984, I had just finally accepted that I just had to live like that forever because I didn't believe that divorce was right. And I had married him for sickness and in health and for better or for worse. And I knew he was sick. I really knew he was sick. So I thought that I had to stay there. So anyway, in 1984, his parents came to me and said, "We need to get him some help." I said, "I'm not putting him anywhere." And they said, "Will you go with us and talk to him?" I said, "Yeah, we'll all talk to him together." Well, we still thought he needed a psychiatrist, his parents too. So we talked him into going to a psychiatrist in, of all places, Augusta, Georgia. And so he agreed, but he wasn't going that night. It was going to be the next morning. So, of course, he did what he was supposed to do that night. He drank. He left the house and he went and drank. I would have too if I was an alcoholic. And I sat there, and I had gotten to the point that I couldn't feel. I had no feelings. I couldn't cry, couldn't laugh. I was just like a robot. Well, all of a sudden, I got to thinking about taking him to Augusta. And I knew he would take something to drink. I didn't know for sure about the guns, but I thought, I just can't do it. And I just started crying and couldn't quit. And I thought, what am I going to do? So I called that minister, and I asked him if he would go with me. And he said that he had a funeral, and he couldn't but not to go by myself to get his parents to go. So I did get his mother to go. And we got him there. We put him in under the psychiatrist. And they made me mad, too. I told them everything. And they said he had a problem with alcohol. See, I was convinced then that it was all mental and nothing to do with alcohol anymore. So they moved him into an alcohol and drug treatment wing of that hospital, which I know now he needed to be in. So he goes up there, and they ask me, would I be willing to tell, how did I feel about things at this point? And I said, well, I'm to the point that if he doesn't get some help, I just don't know if I can keep going. And they said, are you willing to tell him that? And I think by this time, even without Al-Anon, I was to the point that I knew I could not live like that anymore. So I was willing to tell him that. So it got time to go get him at this treatment center. And I went by myself. And I went and got him, and we came home, and he called an AA member, a contact that he had, and we started going to AA and Al-Anon. Now, I couldn't get him sober, but by God, I was going to make sure he stayed sober. So we go to these meetings, and the first two or three we went to, of course, I had to drive. He didn't have any license. First two or three we went to, I'd sit with him because they happened to be open AA meetings, and I'd kind of punch him when I thought he ought to hear this, you know. And then we'd get in the car and go home, and I'd tell him what he needed to hear. I was afraid he didn't hear it. Anyway, so we're going along, and all of a sudden one night we're sitting there before the meeting, and this woman that kind of had a gruff voice came up to me. Now, you know, I knew about Al-Anon. I'd been in 1977, and this is June of 84. And she said, I believe you need to come in this room over here. So I went into the Al-Anon room in June of 84 and has stayed ever since. But anyway, I went in there, and she turned in our One Day at a Time book, which is the daily reader for Al-Anon. She turned in the back, and she showed me pages on controlling. Now, this woman had just met me. And she said, She said, I believe you need to read these pages. Well, I didn't know I had a problem with control at that time, so I just read them, you know. And so we're going to AA and Al-Anon every day, every night. And we're going along, and you know what I felt when I went into Al-Anon? I felt love. I had not felt any love for a long time because I couldn't feel these feelings. There was just a little bit of hope. First, my hope was that he was going to stay sober. They used to tell me over and over, Linda, take the focus off the alcoholic and put it on yourself. And it took me a while. It didn't just happen at the first meeting when somebody told me that. I had to talk about him. But you know why I had to talk about him? It's because that's all I knew. I had lived all those years focused on him. It was like a mule with blinders on. I couldn't see but one thing, and that was him, and getting him fixed. And they're telling me to take the focus off him and look at myself. And I was eventually able to do that. But there was hope that he would stay sober, but I stayed long enough that I began to believe what it says in Al-Anon. There's hope for me whether the alcoholic still drinking or not. And I'm grateful that I stayed because he didn't make 90 meetings in 90 days. He got drunk after about 2 months of going to AA. And I'll never forget when he came in and I knew he was drinking. But I was reading, going to meeting every night, and I was reading everything I could get my hands on. I was just trying to absorb this stuff, you know. I wanted to do differently. I really wanted to be different and to do it differently. And so when he came in drinking, what I would have done in the past was let him have it with both barrels. I didn't want to do that this time. So I looked at him and I said, he was trying to hide it, of course. And I looked at him and I said, I know you've been drinking. But you know, that's your choice. I said, I can't do anything about it. And I went to Al-Anon. And so I was real proud at that level that I could do even that. So I keep going to meetings and he keeps drinking. And sometimes he'd go. Of course, I'd drag him to meetings even drunk sometimes. Because when I heard a woman say, just bring them and prop them up. They may hear something. She shouldn't have told me that. But anyway, sometimes I would take him, but I kept going to Al-Anon, and I kept working on myself. Well, we would, after about 6 months in the program, now I want to say this, Al-Anon does not tell us what to do, does not give us advice as far as whether you stay with a person or leave a person. But after 6 months in the program, I decided I couldn't live like that anymore. He never pointed another gun at me, but he was drunk and he was slinging guns around. Shot a dog in front of me one time, and he loved dogs. But I mean, you know, everything was progressing and it was getting worse. He did do this one time. I'll share this. He had a .357 Magnum, and this was before I got into Al-Anon, and he would hold it to his head and he'd say, if you of course I was threatening to leave. They told me after I got in the program, don't do that. Say what you mean and mean what you say. But at that time, before Al-Anon, I would threaten to leave, and he'd hold the gun to his head, and he said, if you leave me, I'll blow my brains out. So then I'd start begging him, oh, please, please don't, please don't. I won't leave. He'd go out of the house and shoot the gun. And I'd run out there because I just knew he was dead. And he didn't just do this one time. It was over and over and over. And I remember one of the last times he did it, I thought, I wish he would kill himself. I thought he was my problem, and if he was gone, I wouldn't have a problem. And then in the next breath, I thought, oh my God, I wish that, and if he kills himself, it'll be my fault. So that's how I was all the time. But anyway, after I got into Al-Anon, and he started drinking again, and he was slinging those guns around, I got frightened. I was really scared, and I thought, I just can't go on like this. So I decided to leave. And so we didn't have any children, and we lived on his family's farm. So I packed up, and I left. And I had no intentions at that point of divorce. See, I had tried everything but one thing I hadn't tried. I never left him. And I was trying to admit that I couldn't do anything, But in back of my mind, I knew there was one thing I hadn't done, and it might work. So I left, and I was scared, and so I left, and I wouldn't tell him where I was. And finally, when I did let him know where I was, I'd gotten a sponsor right away. She said, she told me her experience. This had happened with her. And she said, tell him, if you mean this, tell him that if he comes to see you when he's drinking, that you'll call the law. And if you say it and he knows you mean it, he won't come, he won't bother you. So I did tell him that. And you know, my feelings were hurt. My pride was hurt. We were separated 9 months before I got the divorce. And he never once came to see me. He knew I meant it, and he was drinking. He wasn't going to come. He called. He'd call drunk. He'd call when he wasn't drunk. He'd cuss me out, and he'd beg me to come back. And all this went on. Now, I'd like to say I really detached, like you do with this light bulb, that I really detached right away, and I left him alone. That's not true. It takes time for me. It's a process. And after I left, there was a few times I had to go back and make sure he was okay. I had to make sure he had food. I had to make sure I'd take him to a meeting. You know, this kind of stuff. But gradually, I was letting go. And I did change groups at that time because if he went to the other one, I had moved too, so I was going to one closer. And of all people, when I got to that group, the woman that said, you need to look at this with that controlling, she became my sponsor. And she loved me to death, but she wouldn't let me get away with anything. So anyway, I'm going to Al-Anon on a regular basis, and I'm working the steps. I'm beginning to really do the steps. I'm going to a lot of meetings, and I'm getting involved in service work, and I'm going to a lot of AA weekends and Al-Anon things. And all of a sudden, I meet this guy in AA, and he was cute. Now, I didn't think it was right to date when I was still married. So I have to admit, I didn't want to get dishonest, but I have to admit that part of the reason I went ahead and got the divorce is because I wanted to date somebody else. But there was another reason. I was really working on myself. I was living by myself. I was really working the steps, and I was praying and asking God what he would have me to do. See, I'm like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says. I'm self-will run riot. And I recognized that, and I didn't want to do that anymore. When I prayed, thy will be done, I had never meant it before. It was all right if God do it my way. But I was really praying, wanting God's will to be done. So I continued to do that, and I prayed for him, and I prayed for me, and I prayed for the marriage, and I was trying to do the right thing. So it was really a very, very difficult decision for me, but then it helped it along when I met this other guy. But anyway, so I used to tell people I fell in lust. And you know what? My sponsor, she was really good. She looked at me one day. I was telling her about this guy, just talking about him. And, you know, he had a few faults. Just because he was in AA didn't mean that he didn't have any faults. And I thought he needed to do this and to do that. So I was telling my sponsor this, and she looked at me and she said, Linda, what are you going to do, change him? Well, now, I'd been in just long enough to know I couldn't do that. And I said, no, I just thought I'd be a good influence on him. And she said, you better look at that. So anyway, God did for me what I could not do for myself. As soon as the divorce was over and I could date him, he decided he didn't want me, the one I wanted to change. And you know, I realized when I looked back that I was doing the same thing I had always done. This guy needed me, and I was going to fix him. And it came to, you know, when I realized that, I was able to get on with my life. So I'm, like I said, I'm going to meetings, I'm working on myself, I did a fourth step, and you know, it was just, knocked me for a loop when I realized that I was a controlling person. It's funny how we don't see ourselves until we see ourselves. But I did the fourth step, was doing my fifth step with my sponsor, And when I realized my character defects, I was just overwhelmed. I said, oh, this is terrible. This is terrible. She said, Linda, you did the best you could with what you had, but you know better now. And so from there, I think I really began to grow. I was praying. I was getting a conscious contact with God. And I was trying to do the things I could do. I was still going to meetings. Like I said, I did divorce him, and I was going to weekends. And I had been separated and divorced now about over a year. And I met Rip Smith. Some of you knew him. We were at a weekend, a Serenity weekend at Jekyll Island, and my sponsor introduced us. Well, I still kind of was after this other guy. So I liked Rip. He had a great personality, but I didn't want him at that point. But we became good friends. And we began to just see each other at assemblies and see each other at AA weekends, and we were just good friends. He would call occasionally. Finally, in 1986, we saw each other at a AA roundup, and he said, can I come see you? We lived about 70-something miles apart, and I didn't have anybody, and I was through with that other guy that wouldn't have me. So I said, okay. And he came to see me, and 6 months later, we were married. I told everybody I was all right till he touched me. If he had just not touched me, I was all right. But no, we did really have something special. And I know that God put us together because it wasn't what Linda was doing. It was God did it for us. We started seeing each other, and he was about 3 years sober, and I was about 2 years in Al-Anon. And we were going to a lot of meetings and everything. And so we got married, and I moved away across Georgia. And when we got married, Rips, I wanted children. I had never had children. He had two in their 20s, grown. He was a little bit older than me. And so he knew I wanted children. See, this fantasy, this dream of the little white house and the picket fence and the two children and living happily ever after. Now, I could have told you that I was into reality, that, you know, Al-Anon had got me there, and I no longer had that dream, and I no longer had that fantasy that it was going to be like that. But, hey, I don't care if you're 40 years old. When you fall in love, you can get these dreams again. So anyway, so I was feeling like that. But anyway, Rip and I talked about having children. And he said, why don't we just leave it in God's hands? So I got pregnant on the honeymoon. I always said I just had the wrong man. But anyway... But I didn't know I was. I lost that baby at 6 weeks. And I was okay. I thought, hey, I can. So then I really worked hard for 2 more years to get pregnant because I really wanted children. And in the meantime, Rip had gotten hurt at the railroad and hurt his back and couldn't work. And he wasn't real thrilled when I turned 42 years old and was pregnant. But I was just overjoyed. I was beside myself. I was so excited. So I carried that baby 3 months, and I lost that baby. Now, what program I had, and I would have told you at that time that I had a pretty good program. It went out the door. I got angry with everything, everybody, and I just was not okay. And everybody around me, I made them as miserable as I was. But the two things I did right is I kept going to meetings, and I called my sponsor. I would cry and boo-hoo and carry on, but I kept doing it. I'd go to meetings, but I didn't want to be there, but I kept doing it. One night we were laying in bed, and I was carrying on about this stuff, and I said something, and Rip said, Linda, you're angry with God. And I thought, me? Sweet little old me? No. And the next breath, I thought, God, why did you let me get pregnant if you were going to take my baby? And I realized I was angry. I was angry with God. And see, even through all the drinking and all the other things that had happened, I had never been there. I had always held on to God. That's how I got through. I knew He was there. I used to lay in the bed during the drinking years. I'd pray, oh God, just take me on. I don't want to hurt or anything, but just let me die and just take me out of this, because I didn't know any way out, you know. But I'm laying there and I realize that I'm angry with God. I heard somebody say in a meeting that it doesn't matter whether you mean it or not, pray. And so I began to pray. And I heard somebody say that they say their prayers when they wake up in the morning before they get out of bed. Because when their feet touch the floor, their mouth comes open. And I thought, oh, that sounds just like me. So I started praying. And I prayed, I still do it. When I wake up, it's become a very, very good habit. When I wake up in the mornings, before I even get out of the bed, I began to pray. And I started praying differently. I started thanking God for what I did have, not for what I didn't, not crying over what I didn't have. And the healing began. I began to get better. And then I would pray and turn every day, turn my will and my life over to God's care, and I would ask Him to show me what He would have me to do. And I still do that every day. So I'm going along and things are getting better. I'm beginning to work with a lot of family members of alcoholics, and I was at a convention and someone said to me, it was after I lost the child, they said, you know, Linda, God has put a lot of children in your path. And she was talking about Al-Anon girls that I was sponsoring and people I was working with. Just look how many people He's put there for you. And somehow that kind of started the healing. But you know how good God is. He let me be a grandma. Rip's son and his wife had a little girl, so right after I lost the baby, I got to start being grandmother to this child. So God is so good. So we're going along, and we've got it going great. Rip and I are doing great. We're very good friends still. He's my lover, my husband. We're just, everything is wonderful. And he's speaking. We came up here. I never did figure out which year, Jerry. And he spoke at this roundup, and we're going all over the United States, and he's speaking, and I'm speaking some. And, you know, we're just having a wonderful time. And we're working with a lot of people and doing a lot of things. And we've got his children and the grandchild and my family, and everything's wonderful. Everything's wonderful. And my conscious contact with God was better. I was at peace. I finally had a conscious contact with God of my understanding that I had never had before. And I kept doing what I had been doing. Rip used to say sometimes in our marriage, he said, you know, as long as I worked my program and Linda was working her program, everything was wonderful. He said, even if I wasn't working my program and Linda was working her program, everything was wonderful. He said, or if the other way around. He said, but oh, those days when neither one of us were working a program. So, you know, even though it was wonderful, and it was a wonderful marriage, there's always problems in everything, and there were some times that weren't so good. But we had the program, and I'm so grateful for that, and we were able to work through them. So like I said, we're going along, and everything's great. And I think I've got everything just wonderful. Got the relationship with God of my understanding, the husband of my dreams, and I'm thanking God for the good that I've got. I'm not crying anymore over what didn't come true in my dream and my fantasy. July 1995, Rip was diagnosed with terminal cancer. My world fell apart. And I thought, what am I going to do? He's my best friend. I can't go on. But you know, all that time that I was praying and I was asking God and thanking God for what I had, excuse me, and thanking God for His goodness to me and trying to do God's will, I heard somebody say this one time, I was buying insurance for the times that weren't so good. So we're going along and he's diagnosed, and of course I don't want to believe that it's terminal. I don't want to believe he's not going to live. So I'm the kind that I'm the cheerleader. I'm in there perking everybody up. And I'm telling him, Rip,
God has already performed one miracle on you. You're sober. He can do it again. And I said, and I would just all the time, but you know, it wasn't me keeping us up as much as it was real. I've never seen anybody go through what he did the way he did it. He was able to keep going, you know, getting out of the house and not hospitalized. He had a tremendous amount of pain, and he also was losing weight rapidly, you know, through that time. But he had the best attitude you've ever seen. He had a spiritual life that I've never dreamed about having. He had that relationship with God of his understanding. And we're going along, and it was a constant flow of AA and Al-Anon people in and out of our house the whole time. And some of the guys he sponsored and worked with would say, but I don't understand, Rip, why you? He'd say, why not me? Why not me? And I'd say, and he'd tell them just to pray for God's will. And I'd tell him, but Rip, we need to pray for you to be healed. We need to pray this. He'd say, Linda, just pray for God's will. Just pray for God's will. It'll be okay. And so at first, during this time of his illness, and I knew intellectually that that's what I needed to do, but I couldn't get it here because I knew probably what God's will was from what the doctors had said, that he was going to die. And I wanted to believe and to pray for God's will, but I couldn't do it for a while. And finally, as he was getting weaker and weaker, and it was obvious that he wasn't going to make it without a miracle, somehow I began to accept that he was going to die, and slowly accept that. And I truly was able to pray and ask God for his will to be done. I didn't want him to suffer anymore. If that was God's will, I was ready for him to go. So on January 26, 1996, he died in my arms in our bed. And I'm so grateful for a lot of things. He was in his right mind up to the day he died. His body wasted away, but his mind was there. And he didn't have to struggle and fight. God was with us when he left. And he just went so peacefully. And that's a blessing. But when he died, I thought, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I didn't want to live. I did not want to live. I thought, this is just too hard. I had an Al-Anon friend from Mississippi that sent me a poem, and she had personalized it like it was a letter from Rip. And I can't quote it, but it says, said something like, Dear Linda, heaven is so bright and beautiful. It's wonderful here. I love you deeply and I miss you. But this line stood out, said, and one day it'll be wonderful when you're here with me, but your work is not done. And I thought, but God, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? But that stood out, and that made me say, all right, well, I never wanted to commit suicide, but I just didn't want to live. But anyway, I didn't want to live without him. You know, I learned in this program that my happiness cannot depend on another person. I tell you what, he made me real happy. But if my happiness depended totally on him, I would not be standing here today. I'd been dead or in a loony bin. So I understand that we can make each other happy, but our total happiness cannot depend on another person. But anyway, after that, I got that from her. I began to realize that God wasn't through with me yet. There was work for me to do. There was something for me to do. Well, like I said, the AA and Al-Anon friends were there. They held us up, and they were there after he died. But after the funeral, I only had a good friend, Connie, that's with me this weekend, and my sisters, and a couple of other good friends that were still there for me, there as far as coming to my house. Still, there was a lot of you all over that sent me cards, and I'm grateful for all of that. But it was just so alone. I mean, it was just so, there was nobody there. Well, I had to work. I wasn't old enough. I was 49 when Rip died. I wasn't old enough to draw his railroad retirement. So I was back out in the workforce. And I'm grateful that God provided and that I was able to. And I'm grateful for this, that I had to, because all I wanted to do was lay down and pull the covers over my head. I didn't want to go to meetings. I didn't want to work. I didn't want to get out. But I had to do it. I had to do it. And I would get out. I would just put one foot in front of the other and keep going. I kept praying, and I added something to my prayer. Every time I thanked God, I started thanking God for the time I had with Rip. I didn't want to go through that valley again of being angry with God. I didn't want to have to go there. And all that prayer, all that time, thank God that I had continued and that He was there for me and He held me up. But I still, to this day, instead of getting angry because He's gone, I'm just grateful that I had Him, the time that I had Him with me. And I continue to pray that and thank God every day that I had Him with me. I was going to a lot of meetings and I kept hearing people say, God's will won't lead you where His grace can't sustain you. And I know that God was holding me up and still is today. I think about the footprints in the sand. There are a lot of times, especially that first year, Rip's been dead 2.5 years now. A lot of times during that first year, I couldn't have made it if God hadn't been carrying me. There was only one set of footprints in the sand because He was carrying me. I couldn't walk. I told somebody when I was talking one time, I said, Lord, He's put me down and I wish He'd pick me back up. But I think He puts us down to walk beside Him. And He does pick us back up when we can't make it on our own. But God has been so good to me. And I try and I keep trying to ask Him, what would you have me to do? I know that God wants me to be a maximum service to Him and to my fellow man. And I don't know that I know I fall real short. But I just keep going and I keep trying to serve as far as service work. I stayed in service work and I'm now trying to serve as the area delegate, like she said. And I just keep trying to serve and do for others and help people. And I talk to a lot of family members of alcoholics, try to get them in Al-Anon, and I sponsor a lot of Al-Anons. Almost a year after Rip died, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I thought, that's okay. Maybe God's going to take me on home to be with Him. And that was my reaction to being told I had cancer. And then I thought, oh gosh, I don't want to go through what you might have to go through though, because I had watched him and watched my mother and watched a lot of other people die with cancer. And it was all right for me to go, but I just didn't want to hurt. But anyway, God would bless me again, and why He wants to keep me here, I don't know, really. But they had caught it very early, and I had bilateral mastectomies and the cancer, simple mastectomies, and they got all the cancer. I did not even have to have chemotherapy. I didn't have to have radiation therapy. They think they got it all. I had reconstruction, and I went through that the first year. In 96 was the year, at first year Rip died, and then in 97 I was going through all that. And when 98 rolled around, I said, what's going to be this year, God? I didn't say it very loud, but I haven't had any illnesses. But I'm doing real well from that, and I'm so grateful. And I try to be grateful. I try to want to live. I try to want to serve Him. And I try to stay very enthusiastic and very positive. And you know, the only way I can is because God is doing for me what I cannot do for myself. I try to do the little footwork. I try to pray. I try to go to meetings. I try to work with people. And He just gives me the strength to keep going. And that's all I know to do. But I'm real grateful that I didn't want to talk all too long. But I appreciate y'all listening. I like to close with this because I guess if I'm trying to strive for anything, this is what I'm striving for in this program, and this is the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. Lord, make me an instrument of Thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. and where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. And it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. I love you. Bye-bye.